Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Imagine yourself at a New York law firm, one specializing in tax advice for the wealthy. Dark, polished wood, indirect light on the fine art, the hum and the whisper of high-priced advice and money. Now imagine yourself in a plain wooden church pew in Alabama listening to a preacher read from James chapter 5, verse 1. Listen, you rich people, weep and wail because of the misery that is coming upon you. Your wealth has rotted and moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. Well, if we were looking for a biblical verse to start this hour about American tax policy, our guest Susan Pace Hamill says this one would do very well. As a lawyer, Hamill knows the money world of tax shelters, and now as a Christian, she's bringing the fire and brimstone of the Bible to expose what she calls the sinful tax code of Alabama. She's getting plenty of attention. Hamill says the taxes paid by poor people there are so high compared to what the wealthy landowners pay that the system is immoral. And she's challenging other believers in Alabama to apply spiritual teaching to taxes. Well, Connection listeners, should the Bible be taken into account when rewriting tax policy? Is it still possible to tip over the tables of the money changers in the temple? Should one test of tax policy be its morality? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour is Susan Pace Hamill. She's a professor of tax law at the University of Alabama School of Law. She's joining us from Alabama Public Radio in Tuscaloosa. Hi, Susan.
Good morning.
We need to go back a few years, I guess, to a time when you, in fact, were in one of those high-priced New York offices helping the rich get richer, because you were there once, were you not?
I did practice law in New York City for 4 years after my tax degree at NYU, so you're correct.
Did you like that?
Well, I mean, we worked very hard, and you are right. We did tax planning for wealthy businesses. And at the time, I was having fun with the intellectual work, but sort of dimly realized that there had to be more meaning to my work, and I think I've finally found it down here. Tax planning ought not to be just for the rich, but it ought to seek to set out a fair system for everybody, which includes the poor, who are largely voiceless in the tax world.
Now, your father had warned you about this, hadn't he? He said before you went off to work in the New York law firm that he wasn't too sure that's what you should be doing.
Oh, I think he put it a little more strongly. He said positively it was not what I should be doing because I had been raised to be more compassionate than that, and he saw it as a waste of a career and a good mind and put it in those terms. This was back in 1983 when I announced my intentions to go to NYU, the tax program.
Now, Susan, your career took you from the plush carpets of the New York legal offices to the IRS in Washington to the law school in Alabama. But what was it that drew your attention to the taxes that the poor pay in your state?
You know, it's funny because for the first 7 years I taught at Alabama, I didn't even realize that the tax code was so oppressive and unfair. I should have realized it. I should have noticed that the property taxes on my own home were ridiculously low. I should have noticed that I was constantly kicking in money for things for my kids' school that ought to be covered in the budget. And Tuscaloosa City is one of a handful of schools that meets minimum adequate funding. But I just didn't notice those things. I had to get out of the law school into the divinity school, which is where I did my sabbatical. And all of a sudden, little signs that had always been there started popping up before my eyes. And 2 hours of research later, I realized I was sitting on the most unfair, worst structure that you could ever dream up.
Now, before you get me to that, what was it that took you from the School of Law to the Beeson Divinity School in Birmingham? That seems like an odd shift.
It wasn't. Well, many people thought it was an odd shift, including some of the folks at the university I had to convince to approve the sabbatical. You know, we professors get sabbaticals, and I wanted to spend mine broadening my mind and finding a way to look at my areas ethically instead of just writing another article, and my minister and I cooked up this idea to send me to the Beeson Divinity School, which is a top-rate place. They have top people, very conservative evangelical in approach, which is different than what I was accustomed to as a mainline Protestant, but very drivable from where I live, and so off we went. It was about that way.
Now, did you become one of those conservative evangelical types that you're talking about?
You know, I consider myself a moderate evangelical type, and there aren't too many of us around. I mean, many of the views of the evangelicals I disagree with, but I found while I was there that many of their views and ways of looking at things, in fact, are the right one. And we can learn a lot from top evangelicals. I mean, they're very serious about their faith, and when they see something wrong, they come at it with a sense of urgency that some of us mainliners lack, in a sense.
So here you are, with a law degree in one hand and a Bible in the other hand, taking a look at the Alabama tax code, and what is it that draws your attention to it? What is it that sort of snaps for you?
Well, to do an ethical analysis under biblical principles, you have to, you can't just throw out a few verses. You have to develop kind of a train of theme and take it through the canon and then develop principles. And you have to do a lot of work on the context of the text and the history. And I won't get into all of that, but I was able to.
You're talking about legal work, legal research here, right?
Oh, no, I'm talking about the ethical principles Bible. And then from there, I applied the legal structure of the tax code. And the ethical principles that I was able to derive go as follows. 1, thou shalt not oppress the poor. 2, thou shalt allow the poor at least some bare minimum opportunity to better their situation. Now, notice I did not say equal or generous. Mm-hmm. I sort of punt those two issues, but focus on the minimum opportunity, which is more than amply supported by the biblical text. And then I applied those two principles to the tax structure of Alabama and found that both of them are just horribly violated.
Well, what is it about the Alabama tax code that's so wrong?
Well, I mean, to start with, we tax income deep, deep, deep into poverty, $4,600 a year. I mean, the feds don't even start till about 18.5.
Wait a second. Year. You're saying if I earn $4,600 a year as what, a family, as a single person or family of four?
This is family of four.
In 1 year, I'm paying income tax on that?
You start paying income tax. That is correct. We tax deep into poverty on income tax. And then it gets worse. We rely on sales tax for more than half our revenues. And there's areas in Alabama that the combined state and local sales tax reaches 11%. And then we have the gall to not even exempt food and other basic necessities. So if you're buying your jug of milk, you get tacked on 11% on top of that. Now, for a person of means like myself, you barely notice the 11%. But when you're taxing groceries on a family in poverty, you know, in addition to their income tax, that really hurts.
Now, you loop in the timber merchants, the companies that control, 70% of the land in Alabama?
71% of the land is covered up by timber, and they bear less than 2% of the property tax. It took us 6 months to empirically calculate that.
Now we're talking about a different kind of tax. We're not talking about sales or income. We're talking about property tax here, right?
Correct, because in state and local finance, you need a balance between those three, what I call the big three. And what we have in Alabama is a over-reliance on sales tax and an under-reliance on property tax. Property taxes comprise as little as 5% of our revenue when it ought to be at least a fourth. So the property taxes are very low, but even within the different classes of property, the timber and agriculture are what I call especially low, and that's where the proportional calculation came in. Commercial property and homes are carrying the biggest chunk, I mean, 85% of the property tax.
But Susan, why don't they just change the property taxes to bring them up to today's value?
Well, you know, you have to work in our 100-year-old Constitution, which enshrines the low valuation, particularly of timber and agriculture. Now, that's the base. Tax is a question of base and rate. And if your base is so ridiculously low no matter how you know.
You're saying this tax code was set in place 100 years ago and hasn't been changed since then.
It hasn't been changed for the better. It's been built on for the worse. I can put it that way.
Does that mean that it is or carries with it some of the old racism of that time?
Now, I did not look at race carefully. Now, the historical records of the 1901 Constitutional Convention clearly indicate that the purpose for keeping the taxes low, regressive, and inadequate was to keep the free blacks from getting minimum education and health care. And in fact, they also wanted to keep the poor whites poor as well. And, you know, it's funny, the Wall Street Journal asked me for racial statistics, and what we discovered was a quarter of our state is black, but half of our impoverished residents are black. So clearly you have a disparate impact on our African-American residents. But I did not focus on race in my biblical arguments. I punted that. I did focus on poverty and our biblical duty to the poor.
Now, I'm holding in my hand a thick, I don't know, what's that, 80-some-odd pages from the Alabama Law Review entitled...
Actually, it's 112 with the tables.
Yeah, but you see, I get lost in little tables, so I just sort of stick to the text part.
But you realize if you're going to attack Alabamians as having an unchristian tax code, you'd better prove your case with 10 witnesses and DNA, and those tables do that. So they're important, but I understand why you wouldn't want to read them.
So are they paying attention, Susan?
Many people are. I've gotten good responses from some of the churches, and you know, several ministers, and especially big churches, have preached the word on this, urged their folks to get out and support tax reform to cure the inequities. You know, we had a lottery referendum a couple years ago in this state, and I'm totally against a lottery because that's effectively a regressive tax. And the church crowd in Alabama is credited with defeating the lottery referendum.
Now, you've got a brand new governor there, Bob Riley, who has embraced at least the idea of this. Does that mean that 100 years on, maybe the tax code is going to change?
I would hope it would come a lot sooner than 100 years on, and I am greatly hoping that our new governor takes hold of the reins and goes with it, because when you think about it, I mean, my arguments are purely moral, that this is dead wrong under biblical principles, and more than 90% of Alabamians claim to practice some form of Christianity. But when you think about it, from a more selfish point of view, we're really doing ourselves in. If you have an uneducated workforce because the schools are so bad, it's hard to attract new businesses. If you can't attract new businesses, you cannot attract new growth, and you just kind of slink down in your own poverty. This horrible structure is bringing down even those of us with means who are getting away with not paying our share when you look at it from the long-term perspective.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Susan Pace Hamill. We're talking about the morality of the Alabama tax code, and in a broader sense, the morality of taxes themselves, and whether or not morals and ethics should play a larger role in the drafting and the exercise of the way that people are taxed. When we come back after the break, we're going to talk about earlier efforts to try and change this tax code in Alabama and talk further with Susan Pace Hamill. 1-800-423-8255 brings you into the conversation. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this...
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. With me on the program, Susan Pace Hamill. She's a professor of law at the University of Alabama School of Law in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. She's the author of An Argument for Tax Reform Based on Judeo-Christian Ethics. And we're talking about that this hour. We're also joined on the phone by Joey Kennedy. Joey is editorial writer and opinions page editor of the Birmingham Times in Birmingham, Alabama. But more to the point, Joey was part of a team of writers who won a Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing in 1991 for a series entitled, get this, What They Won't Tell You About Your Taxes. So, Connection listeners, it's not as if Susan has stumbled onto something that's brand new. Joey, I need you to help me understand where the argument is now, because you've been writing that, in fact, stuff that you said 10 years ago would still apply today.
Absolutely it would, Dick, and it's the Birmingham News.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. The situation, basically, that series that we published really almost 13 years ago, 12 and a half years ago, could still be published today with an update of basically statistics and those sorts of things, and it would still apply. This is an issue that has been on editorial pages anyway, and specifically our editorial page, since the late 1980s, and when our newspaper recognized that the tax system was unfair and is unfair, and something needed to be done about it.
Now, the politicians weren't paying attention to what was in the papers?
Well, it can always be those people on the editorial page are saying this, but my constituents don't care about it, and so it can be fairly easy to ignore. It became a little bit harder of an issue to ignore when we won the Pulitzer Prize because of the publicity that surrounds something like that. And so there was some movement and some rhetoric at that time, but again, it died down, and it still became mainly an issue that the intellectuals discussed in Alabama, but never reached to the grassroots, and that's why Susan's efforts are important in this area.
You think that the pulpit and the paper working together might in fact make a difference, Joey?
I'm more optimistic now than I've been at any time since I've written about this issue, mainly because in the last campaign we had for governor, the rhetoric had turned toward tax reform and reforming constitution before the election. And those were made as campaign promises for the candidates who were running for office. And so the rhetoric is there now.
And Susan, what do you think? Do you think that you have some kind of momentum now?
Well, I think Mr. Kennedy's right. Previous efforts for tax reform focused on what I would call traditional tax policy arguments, which are very strong, but are largely confined to the intellectual realm. And most Alabamians are not terribly interested in traditional tax policy. It's probably a little bit over their head. It's intimidating. Where bringing it down to a moral level based on moral values that you yourself have adopted probably has a greater potential to reach the average person, which, of course, hopefully will translate into better voting at the voting box.
Now, Joey, the churches have been here before. I was reading something in one of your back issues about a campaign in 99 to try and get the churches involved with this, right?
In fact, most of the denominational organizations have adopted a pro-tax reform policy mostly immediately after the lottery vote here in Alabama, where many of them went out against the lottery on moral grounds. And then many people, including our newspaper, was very aggressive about it, pointed out, well, the tax system is also a moral issue, too. But some of the denominations, especially the Southern Baptist denomination here, came kind of kicking and screaming. But what we needed, what we had, were individual progressive people in the pulpit who spoke about this issue and who have since gotten some sort of grassroots support. And Susan's efforts are exactly what is needed. We need to have the preachers saying, this is what Jesus would do, and approach it from that angle.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. To Tingsboro, Massachusetts, Steve's joining us now. Hello, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think?
I see I see two problems with using religious arguments to justify social policies. The first is when the proponent of a certain message justifies his position as coming from God, who, I mean, let's face it, he only speaks inside your head. There's no way for the rest of us to determine whether that's a genuine divine message or an imagined one. And this leads to situations in which you have proponents on both sides of an issue appealing to the same authority. And we've seen this with slavery, women's suffrage, and we're seeing it now with the war on Iraq. And my second point is the appeal to religious faith is that's the tactic of someone who's already lost the argument. You know, there are plenty of valid points on both sides of this issue to be argued, and to throw your hands up and say, Well, that's what Jesus wants, is telling your opposition that your argument can't be accepted on its own merits.
Stay with us, Steve. I want Susan to talk to you here. Go ahead, Susan.
Yes, I hear your concern loud and clear, and I certainly had the same concern myself while I was at the seminary. If you take a look at the article, it does not merely throw around a few verses and say this is what Jesus would do. It develops a very sophisticated biblical hermeneutical approach. Hermeneutical approach. That is the study of the Bible and how you develop the principles that apply to the 21st century world, despite the fact that the text was written well over 2,000 years ago.
But we don't know who translated it. So.
Well, I did spend 13 hours studying the ancient Greek for the New Testament, so I hear you on the language issue, which is certainly a real one. But to get back to your major point, you are correct that there are a whole host of issues where reasonable minds will disagree what the biblical hermeneutical approach tells us. Most of the hotbed issues of today, in fact, you know, the evangelical interpretation will come out different than the Roman Catholic as well as others. However, I felt very, very strongly, and I studied a lot, prayed a lot, consulted with many people, that I was dealing with something here so fundamentally wrong, so fundamentally unjust, that I was able to find what I would call a broad common denominator of any biblical hermeneutical approach, that what we have going down here in Alabama cannot be defended under any approach, any interpretation, up and down. You know, I don't care how conservative your church is, how liberal your church is, if you think the scriptures matter to you, this cannot be tolerated, which goes to the second concern you raised.
You take it one step further, though, Susan. You're not saying it can't be tolerated. You're saying that the Christians have an obligation to do something about it.
That's right, because over 90% of us down here in Alabama claim to be Christians. That's what makes the argument relevant to us. It's not that I'm foisting an argument on unwilling people.
Right.
The people of Alabama have adopted these values as their own. We have, you know, tons of churches per capita down here. We say that these principles matter by choice. And what I'm saying is that our state structure, which is reflective of 90% of our people who are supposedly voting, is way out of kilter with the values that we hold near and dear. And for that reason, that we need to close that gap and get back closer to our values and treat the poor fairly.
All right, we've got a number of callers here. So, Steve, thanks for yours to Louisville, Kentucky. Now, Mike's on the line. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Yes, I'd like to weigh in. I'm a Roman Catholic, and I'm excited about this article. I'm going to get a copy of it somehow or another.
I'll tell you, you can get it from our website. We're at theconnection.org, and there's a link to it there, so that should keep it simple for you.
Thank you. I just want to weigh in for us that the Roman Catholic officials, you know, social teaching from the Pope says that we're supposed to have a preferential option from the poor, but this is certainly not focused on taxes. And were not for Alabama, I guess Kentucky would have the lead in taxing the poor in a maximum sort of way. But I want to thank you, Susan, for the work that you've done. I want to get a copy on it of the article. And I think any church that buys into strict individualism, that is, that religion is strict on the individual thing, is not going to, you know, jump in on your cause. And I'm certainly interested to see how you would, you know, started this linking of churches to get together to preach this, I guess, and to have an adopted policy change for the state. I think evangelicals and Catholics' theology on shaping policy would very much work hand in hand on this real basic issue.
Susan?
Yes, I agree with that. And I spent a great deal of time and citation in my article developing what I call the moral duty of the Christian. And it's heavily linked to Luke's gospel, much is given, much more is required, which that short sentence asks the question, what kind of opportunities does this person have to shape the world around them? Do you live in a democratic regime where you can vote? If you do, then your voting needs to reflect your conscience and your values. Do you have an education that allows you to speak with a voice that can be heard? Do you have more money than everyone else that gives you opportunities related to that? Are you holding a political office which gives you direct opportunities to shape social policy. All of those opportunities speak to the duty, the moral duty of the Christian. And the more opportunities you have, the greater your moral duty is.
Sorry, I'd just like to hear once more from Joey, if I could, because Joey, Mike makes the call from Kentucky and a comparison to what goes on in his state. And I know that in Susan's writing, she makes a comparison about property tax that the timber companies pay between the state to the east of you in Georgia and what goes on in Alabama. Will those kinds of comparisons help make the argument in Alabama? Will they give it any kind of political weight to, you know, convince people, hey, we're not as well off as we should be compared to our neighbors?
Well, we're not. The problem is making that argument. That particular argument has been made for years. I mean, those are the arguments that we've been making, and we've tried to make them on a personal level and how it affects you and how it affects your education system and why we don't have money, and these are some of the reasons. But the most important, I think, message that you have to give when you're trying to fix a tax system is to make the tax system fair, to make the people have a sense that their tax system is fair. And whether you're a religious person or you're not a religious person, Dick, our tax system is immoral. It is a bad tax system that is oppressive to the poor, and it has to be changed.
Joey, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Thanks a lot.
Joey Kennedy is editorial writer and opinions page editor with the Birmingham News and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for editorials specifically on tax policy. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Next to Andover, Massachusetts, and Ruth's on the line. Hi, Ruth.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for letting me be on the air. I'm Jewish. I'm not a Christian. But I have no difficulty with using any argument you can use to change the tax code, because it's not only morally wrong to tax the poor more than the rich, it's also economically unsound, because let's face it, the rich have more money, and if you tax them at a lower level, you still get more money from them.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, though, Ruth, that the sort of campaign that you've heard Susan describing will make any difference to changing what's pretty well dug in, not just in Alabama, but in most of the country?
I would hope so. I'm a pragmatist. Whatever works, works.
Susan,
amen,
what do you
sister.
Susan?
What?
Go ahead, Susan.
I said, amen, sister. I totally agree with you. And if you look carefully at the footnotes of my article, my arguments apply equally to those of the Jewish faith. In fact, all of my moral principles were developed out of the Old Testament and were affirmed and arguably strengthened by Jesus in the New Testament. But we're hand in hand on this one. It's just there's so few folks down in Alabama practicing Judaism that just on a pragmatic basis, I relegated that to a footnote. It was not to leave anybody out. So if you have an unfair tax structure, let's say in some other part of the country where you do have a significant level of folks practicing Judaism, then you can trot my paper out and use it there on all fours.
Susan, I wonder if the principles that you're applying to the Alabama tax system are the sort of principles that you think ought to be applied to tax cut policies that we see from Washington, the recent announcement from the president that they're going to go ahead with jumping ahead tax cuts, cutting taxes paid on dividends. That's a controversial thing in the Capitol.
Yes, it is. And I have done a lot of thought about that. And in fact, I'm working on a research project that will directly try to apply moral principles to various tax policy options in Washington. It's a much more complicated topic because currently the federal tax structure does not, you know, tax the poor the way Alabama does. The real issue federally is, do we spread the burden more upstream or do we burden the middle class more? And that's a more complicated issue. But my gut response is that I'm a bit disturbed about tax cuts that are more favorable at the top of the stream because, of course, those folks need it the least. But I'm also mindful of some of their economic arguments that, well, you discourage hard work and the rest of that. And there's a bazillion economic studies on both sides of the issue as to whether flat versus progressive taxes encourage a more, quote, vibrant economy, and I'm in the process of looking at those. I do want to say, though, that in the end, and I feel this very strongly, that tax policy is a moral issue, and whether it's a whether you look at Judeo-Christian principles or some kind of utilitarian thinking or another, I mean, there are several ways to look at moral problems. But the problem with tax policy today is we focus too much on the economic studies. How is this going to affect the economy? How is this going to affect whether people work an extra hour? And we treat those economic studies, which are controversial and conflicting, as giving us an answer rather than merely giving us information to better evaluate the moral dilemma.
But Susan, the people who make the changes are the politicians, and the people who the politicians depend on are the powerful corporate leaders like the timber owners in Alabama or the lobbyists in Washington who make sure the tax policy works first for them and not necessarily on a moral basis.
Well, that you've hit your head. You've hit.
I know I hit my head on this one daily.
I mean, you have identified the problem big time in that there's too much influence of, you know, to the politicians of those who can best pay them and lobby them and contribute to their campaign. That's what's kept Alabama down for so many years. The
right.
special interest groups have funded the politicians and nothing has changed.
And how do you
and
change?
That is not moral. Tax policy is supposed to fairly burden everybody, not just those that can buy the lobbyist.
And this is something that you change by force of numbers with votes at the ballot box.
That's right. Making people aware so that they can vote more responsibly, which, if you have responsible voting on a mass scale, the lobbyists are only going to be able to buy so many votes.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Susan, on to something here. Applying morals to taxes instead of just trying to figure out what the best way of stimulating a moribund economy is. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. This hour, we're talking about Alabama tax policy with Susan Pace Hamill, and through Susan, about the morality of tax policy in general. Susan's research pointed out, after some considerable time in the books, that the timber industry in Alabama, they call themselves ALFA, the Alabama Farmers Federation, owns or controls 71% of the land in that state and contributes just 2% of the state property tax revenue. We asked representatives of the Alabama Farmers Federation, the timber companies, to join us on the program. They declined. Susan, I wonder whether or not you're getting their attention.
You know, I've heard very little from ALFA directly, although I have a number of friends in Birmingham that practice law that are in business meetings all the time where those folks are usually on opposite ends, but sometimes the same end of the conference table. And I've been told that ALFA doesn't like me much.
What a surprise.
No, I can't say I'm surprised. Although my message to ALFA, and I'm assuming most of them are Christians as well, since almost everybody else is around here, that there is still time for them to repent and atone. I mean, the fact that you've reamed the state for decades and decades does not mean that you can't see the light and get under the tent and work for a fair system, and then all is forgiven going forward. That is the arch principle of the Christian faith, that atonement can come at any time once your wrong has been put before you. So that would be my plea to ALFA, is atone, repent, and get under the tent and help us come up with a fair system that defines what should timber's share be. It's less than 2%. And, you know, we treat the 50-acre owner for hunting the same as the 100,000 pine farm which is ridiculous among itself. I mean, we need to define what their share ought to be of the bigger property tax pie that we must have, and we've got to make sure that within that share that the landowners are treated equitably based on, you know, how many acres they own and what they're doing with it.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Next to Boston, Massachusetts, Russell's on the line. Hi, Russell.
Hi, good morning. Great show.
Thanks for calling.
Really interesting couple of things going on here. You've already had some callers saying, you know, just pragmatically, utilitarian, good sense, common sense, Jewish, Christian. It seems really clear from the argument given by your guest, just on basic common sense and the facts as we hear them, that this is not working well for the citizenry in general. In Alabama, and I'd have to say in nationally as well, with the impoverished citizens of the country, the tax loopholes for the wealthy corporations, for wealthy individuals, are such that, I mean, we look at Enron, right? No taxes for how many years? You look at the problem and you say, gosh, looks pretty serious, seems pretty clear. And then, and you said it, you've been hitting your head up against it for years. Why can't we change it? Well, I don't think that it's a Christian issue. I really don't. I mean, we have a great Christian foundation in this country, but it's just it's a human problem. And if the religious leaders would get out there, I mean, Jesus turned the tables over. You know, if people are happy to just go to church on Sunday and preach and teach and say, let's go back to work now, okay, nothing's going to change for another 100 years, which I think is a very cynical attitude, and I don't want to see that happen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to see religious leaders get out there and outraged, say, President Bush, this can't go on, not now, no more. I want to see it on the state level. I mean, I want to see people get out there. I'll get on the bus if you get organized. I mean, don't mourn, organize. So where's it going to happen? How's it happening? I want to hear it.
Well, Susan?
Well, you hit on a very good point. I take you back to the civil rights era. How did it happen then? The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., first and foremost, was a Christian minister. I mean, I believe that we do have a religious foundation in this country. Everybody touts religion. And the churches do need to get involved in the moral issue of tax policy. And then maybe something will happen. If you leave it to the intellectuals, who certainly can evaluate it in very technical and highfalutin terms, the average person doesn't understand. And they basically get schnookered at the ballot box into voting for politicians that have been bought off by lobbyists. So I hear what you're saying.
I hate to be the wet blanket here, but in churches that I've been in, quite often the people who are at the senior level of the church, and I'm not talking about the preachers, are the wealthy people in the community who may be benefiting from a tax policy which provides them with the same sort of soft ride that you're describing in Alabama. I mean,
you're right.
How do you beat
the
power structure?
And in fact, my article goes after those people with two fists. Basically, I mean, those people tend to often intimidate the ministers into being quiet, you know, sort of on a threat that we won't contribute to your building campaign. And then the ministers are no better off than anybody else, which is exactly the religious hypocrisy that Jesus railed against when he walked on this earth. Those people, wealthy people in churches that use their clout to essentially protect bad tax policy and keep the churches quiet, are committing an abuse against their own religious principles. And I cover that directly in my moral duties with citations.
Russell, can you get the power structure paying attention in the way that Susan's describing it?
Yeah, hey, look, if I'm comfortable, if I'm secure, I'm wealthy, I got a good deal going on, I don't want to give that away, right? But that's not me. Okay, and that's not most of us in this country right now.
Right.
I mean, the income gap, the wealth gap, the power of the dollar. The apathy is just kind of it's tough to get past. I read in Vanity Fair, you know, the country's apathetic. We've got hundreds of thousands of people going to Washington. What are they talking about? It's apathetic. We need to light the fire and keep fanning it. And this whole thing, class warfare. Yeah, you're damn right, class warfare.
Okay, but that we're not necessarily talking about doing it under a religious banner. When we talk about class warfare and ethics and morals, how important is it to?
Who's the last radical who was murdered in this country for his political activism? I'm going to say Martin Luther King. I'm not a historian, but I'm going to just throw it out there. Okay? Christ. Christ got in some big trouble for his activism. You had Dominic Crossan on here, right? Christ, the radical a revolutionary, you know, history. So who's going to get out there? I'm telling you, organize. Of course the churches have a political social thing going on. People want spiritual balm more than they want more headaches and heartaches of political activism in their free time. But it's got to change because it's so bad, and it's getting worse with this administration. And if the church speaks out, if the churches get busy and they put it out there, look, we're going down to Washington. We got buses. We got 20,000 people coming from Boston, and we're going to meet with 300,000 people from the Northeast. I'll get on the bus. Put it out there. Spend your money in advertising. And say, look, we want to see the world stay peaceful, and we want to see it prosper, and we're going to do it through love, cooperation. You know, let's just get active because, you know, the church singing the hymns is it's not helping anybody.
I'm hearing you, Russell. Thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255 to Winthrop, Massachusetts. Mary's with us now. Hi, Mary.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Yeah.
I agree very much with what's being said, and I thank Susan for her work. I sat in a pew in a Catholic church yesterday here in Massachusetts and had the priest pose the question, what would Jesus do? With his point being, Jesus doesn't write tax code, and in our particular case, Jesus doesn't own a multinational drug company. We were talking about AIDS and what we can do to help people and fight that particular battle. So what I want to say is that I think what we have to stress here is a Christian underlying principle is great, and we have to motivate based on that. A further deepening of this message, though, would be make it something civic. We have children who are not sitting in church pews. I looked around my congregation yesterday. I'm 43. Almost everyone in the church, maybe 400 people, were older than myself.
Right.
So what I think we have to do here is certainly build on this, and this is a great initiative. But further than that, we have to make it some sort of
a civic mission. Stop you there, if I can, Mary, because, I mean, if you took this to, for example, the schools, then I can hear the fists being banged about, oh, no, you keep the religion out of the schools.
That's right. We can't do it as a Christian principle. We have to do it as a civic principle. Because, as many of our callers have said, looking at this, you can look at it from a Christian perspective. You can also look at it from a fundamental civic perspective, where it's unfair to tax those amongst us who have less. So having an underlying Christian or Judeo-Christian principle looking at this is fine, and it can be used to organize and get people, perhaps, in a community already together with it. That's one level of organizing. What we also have to stress, though, is that would not be sufficient. We have to carry this further because for those who are not included in this Judeo-Christian principle, we can make the message more broadly known by making it a civic principle. We have civic classes,
right,
where we can introduce this particular debate, whether it's at the junior high school, college, law school level, making sure that this is taught as a civic principle, and certainly using Susan's kind of research. The research has come about because of what Susan's done, looking at it from that perspective.
All right, Mary, I want to thank you very much for your call. You're listening
can
to The Connection from NPR. Yes, you
can
may.
Can I make a quick, amen to Mary. And a whole section of my article examines our tax structure under traditional tax policy and what I would call more civically oriented morals, and Alabama fails on all four there as well. So I hear you. We need to apply many moral principles.
It doesn't really matter what banner people stand under, whether it's a civics banner or a Christian banner or whatever. You're saying if you stick to the morals of it, the ethics of it, what's right and what's wrong, then the
argument— That's exactly right.
Yeah.
With issues such as this— The avoiding taxing those with less, we're really going to come up with a broader common denominator than most people believe in terms of coming out with the right answer for tax policy.
Susan, I'm interested in just where you go with this, because you argue this with the force of a lawyer and the conviction of a Christian, and you make the case that the message can and should be heard by the 95% of Alabamians who call themselves Christian, and I'm sitting here wondering whether or not this is just the really smart legal strategy of Susan Pace Hamill that says, if I can put this in Christian terms, then I've got them, or is it you yourself spiritually saying, ugh, this is wrong, we have to change this?
To be honest, it is a definite combination of both, with your latter point being the most dominant. You know, think about it. You cannot make an argument like this on just cold legal principles. It doesn't work. Some of the best feedback I've gotten on the article and the shorter op-ed versions is that it comes through that you really believe in what you're saying, which is true. The biblical, spiritual, and other educational training I received at Beeson equipped me to realize what I believed, to apply the moral Christian principles to what I believe, and to combine those lawyer characteristics with the tax knowledge and all of that. So I do believe it from, you know, straight from the heart. But I also have the ability to craft it, you know, using my lawyer skills to craft the argument so it makes sense, so that it flows right, so that the documentation is sound. And just doing the empirical research proving how awful Alabama's tax structure is, that less than 2% of the property tax figure on timber. We had to do an original study. It took 6 months. We documented the funding patterns of all 128 school systems, and we prove that the rural areas that only have timber as a tax base are basically can't fund no matter what the millage rate is. And that took skills, you know, that are different than what I would call a spiritual awakening that I received at the Divinity School and all the education there. So I don't want to undermine the you have to do the work, and you have to have the heart. At Beeson, the way we put it is that they train our heads, they give us knowledge, our hands, ability to take action, and our hearts, the moral compass to guide you to the right answer.
You ask a simple, short question in your own pamphlet, and I'm going to ask you for a simple, short answer to the question. What is the moral duty of all Alabamians professing faith in God?
Well, first of all, they need to exercise their right, their voting rights at the ballot box much more responsibly. We have to stop electing these folks pandering to the special interests and the status quo. And Alabamians with more education and resources have greater duties to stand up and use those resources. I hit the political leaders with even greater duties because they are right there, as co-conspirators keeping the status quo. And 96% of them are Christians. I documented our legislature individually. I call it my J. Edgar Hoover file, except it only reveals where they all go to church and what their leadership positions are in the church. And finally, I hit the ministers with the highest moral duty, because they're sitting around allowing this injustice to prevail and not speaking out enough to those in the pews.
Susan, it's been great having you on the program.
Thank you.
Susan Pace Hamels, a professor at the University of Alabama School of Law and author of An Argument for Tax Reform Based on Judeo-Christian Ethics. Thanks to Alabama Public Radio in Tuscaloosa and to station manager Roger Duvall. You can find Susan's research on our website. We are at theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
From Boston University,